Chapter 11. Fellow Travellers. The Jacobins of the 20th century would not guillotine the capitalists. To follow a good example does not mean copying it. V.I. Lenin. St. Petersburg has many revolutionary shrines. Among the oldest, accessible only to pre-booked groups, is a small flat on an upper floor. Opened as a museum in 1938, the blackest year of Stalin's political terror, it is based on the apartment where the Alilueves, the family of Stalin's second wife, had their home in the first two decades of the 20th century. Though Stalin visited more often, Lenin himself sought refuge here in July 1917, and the fact made the place a holy site in the years of Soviet power. The museum has gone through many transformations since, but a striking painting has survived and still hangs in the tiny exhibition space. The work of a Soviet artist called Mikhail G. Sokolov, 1875 to 1953. Its subject is Lenin's arrival at the Finland station on the 3rd of April 1917. In three rooms, small and stuffed with chintz, it is by far the brightest object on display. An art historian would know the picture as a work of socialist realism, a style that was near universal in the Soviet Union by the 1930s. Like many compositions of its kind, all muscles, square jaws and sunshine, it is stronger on the socialism than the reality. But the figure of Lenin in the main spotlight is clear enough. Wearing a dark suit and tie, and brandishing his trademark hat, the Bolshevik leader is stepping from a wagon that is clearly marked 3 class. His general expression is a little wooden, but that may be the artist's way of giving him the same look as the icon painters give to saints. In every other way, this is a work of the secular age. As members of a brass band struggle with their music sheets, it is hard to see how the trombonist in the foreground will ever move his elbows. Everyone else is gathered in the dark green door of the train, some waving caps, and others holding banners high above their heads. The faces shine, the colours blaze, and everyone is having a good time. Apart from Lenin himself, only one character has been allowed to look out of the picture in full face. His gaze bores out of the dark train. His black moustache is unmistakable, as is that crooked eyebrow line. With no regard for awkward facts, Sokolov has placed Stalin among the illustrious passengers. Indeed, although the man was never in Lenin's carriage at all, Sokolov has put Stalin one step above the late leader, suggesting that he could be a mentor or chaperone. Such lies were not unusual by the 1930s. In April 1937, for instance, as the Soviet Union celebrated the 20th anniversary of Lenin's triumph at the Finland station, Pravda felt obliged to pretend that Stalin had been the real impresario in Petrograd. Sokolov went even further, creating a visual fairy tale, a foretaste of communist joys to come. A mere glance at the picture is enough to show that one day the bouquets and glinting steel will be for Stalin, rightfully. The succession is direct and utterly secure. Lenin might have founded the unbreakable Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but Stalin, his heir and truest disciple, will be the man who builds it into the greatest, freest, and happiest land the world has ever seen. The antidote to that idea lurks in a dull glass case at waist height in another corner of the room. Suppressed during the years of Stalin's tyranny, it is a typed list, in Cyrillic, of the passengers who completed the journey on the famous sealed train. Stalin does not feature anywhere this time. Many of the other names seem unfamiliar, especially where people's pseudonyms were later changed, and those of Fritz Platten and Karl Radek are missing because they could not enter Russia when the others did. The exhibition offers no commentary, but the document should not be treated casually, for it would once have been a rare and secret thing. Most of the names on it were censored out of Soviet history books, and by the time of Stalin's death, The lives of those who bore them had largely been forgotten. They knew too much. That was the problem. They knew that Lenin had not thought of Stalin as his heir. They knew what the alternatives had been. They even had a few ideas about the sort of state that they had hoped to build in the far-off days before each fascinating dream dissolved. It is 100 years now since the sealed train crossed Europe under German guard. And yet, the story still has important, even disturbing resonances. In Russia, where moments of hope, of mass engagement in national life, have been so lamentably rare, they have a special poignancy. The mere idea of taking power appalled the politicians who were thrust into office in the early spring of 1917. Instead of addressing the grievances that had placed them in government, moreover, they mainly used them to manipulate the crowds. Nationalist newspapers co-opted hungry and disfigured veterans to blackmail an exhausted public into accepting another year of war. The right blamed Jews and socialists. The left set everyone against the types they chose to call the bourgeoisie. And in the end, democracy could only skulk around the fringes of the revolution like a dog with mange. By contrast, Lenin's answers may have looked seductive for a while. But people are not set free by dictatorships, and violence is not the way to bring them peace. The drama had intriguing roles for foreigners as well. A story that began as high adventure for the likes of Hoare and Knox soon turned into a tragedy for everyone involved. In the same way, there have been many hopeful springs in recent times, not only in the Slavic world, and all have witnessed chanting crowds with flowers, flags and candles for the sacred dead. As modern tyrannies are swept away, and every honest heart delights, the quick-thinking servants of the world's great powers still proffer plans to intervene, to jostle, scheme and sponsor factions that they barely understand. In 1917, their predecessors in Western Europe had a clear set of objectives where Russia was concerned. They wanted military edge to win the war. They wanted all their global influence to last. They also wanted to be winners in the peace, to buy up Russia's minerals and sell their branded shaving soap to merchants in its thriving towns. The order of priorities may well have changed since then, but not the character of government advisers or their basic aims. In 1917, the plans of all the foreign actors in the Russian tragedy backfired. In the process, the European powers succeeded between them in destroying the first and last chance for a free and democratic Russian polity that any could have hoped to see. The most unwelcome lesson for the European actors in the story was the eventual price tag. The German Foreign Ministry might once have balked at Pavu's unabashed demands, but in the aftermath of Lenin's coup, the big man's expenses would come to look like pocket money. By May 1918, with Russia now a battleground for every shade of red and white, the secret agents of the warring European powers were all running up massive bills. Writing from Moscow, which had become the capital of the new Soviet state, the German minister Count von Mirbach requested guidance from Berlin. "I'm still trying to counter efforts of the Entente and support the Bolsheviks," he explained. "However, I would be grateful for instructions as to whether overall situation justified use of larger sums in our interests if necessary." The reply was unequivocal. "Please use larger sums," read his instruction. "If further money required, please telegraph how much." Mirbach believed that he would need a monthly income of 3 million German marks. 2 weeks later, a secret German memorandum increased the estimate to 40 million marks or more. Among the reasons was competing pressure from Britain and France. Expense alone was not the worst of it, however. Another unpleasant discovery was that Lenin and his followers had plans that even German officers could not control. Less than 2 months after the Bolsheviks' accession to power, Radek Center in Stockholm was agitating inside Germany, calling on German troops to lay down their arms, inciting revolution, and according to a memorandum of January 1918, attacking loyal servants of the Kaiser. "We are portrayed as slave drivers and oppressors of the workers," complained an outraged deputy state secretary in Berlin. "It is claimed that we put the workers' leaders in concentration camps, and that we appease the hunger of women and old men with lead and gunpowder." As German civilian suffering deepened in the final winter of the war, such propaganda presented in Radek's fluent German prose was bound to find a ready audience. The hardest truth of all was that no subterfuge on Russian soil could ever be enough to save the German state. The foreign ministry had planned to exploit Lenin only till the Russian army failed. As soon as he had served his purpose, they could leave him to the wolves. Duplicity like that was justified to win the war, and no one was supposed to mourn collateral damage. "In the hands of the Bolsheviks," wrote Mirbach in April 1918, "Moscow, the sacred city, represents what is perhaps the most glaring destruction of taste and style that has resulted from the Russian Revolution." "This is not our concern," commented Kaiser Wilhelm II. "The war lacks style as well." 2 weeks later, reading Mirbach's gloomy report of a meeting in the Kremlin, Wilhelm concluded that he, Lenin, is finished. In fact, within 6 months, the one who turned out to be finished was Wilhelm himself. Defeat brought catastrophe to the German government and misery to the majority of German people. But everyone had suffered as the pressure grew. "If I do ever get home," Arthur Ransom told his mother in the summer of 1917, "I shall drink too much beer and shun the acquaintance of all people who know the difference between a liberal and a conservative. I shan't read a newspaper ever." Sir George Buchanan's health collapsed at several points, but so did that of almost every foreign official in Petrograd. When Harold Williams looked back on Russia's revolutionary year, his first thought ran to excitement and happiness. "There were great emotions," he wrote. "There was a deep and singing joy and a bitter despair, and anger and contempt and reverence, and besides and apart from all that, the sheer and constant fun of it all." But even Williams became a disappointed man. "Sometimes one had the feeling that too many illusions had been torn away," he concluded, "that one had seen things that it was not good to see in this life." Buchanan could not stay in Russia once the Bolsheviks had taken power. He left in January 1918, exhaustion close to breaking him. Not one of London's goals had been fulfilled. The Entente, as a whole, now fell apart. There was an Anglo-Soviet trade agreement in 1921, but relations were always hostile, and the wartime dream of booming trade never materialized. Despite the conspicuous ideological differences, the Germans were the Soviets' main partners in the interwar decades, not least because the victors in the First World War had managed to exclude them both from the European mainstream. Moscow was still involved in a tactical alliance with Berlin on the summer night in 1941, when the Luftwaffe flew unchallenged through its airspace and destroyed 1,200 of Stalin's military aeroplanes in one long-planned surprise attack. Sir Samuel Hoare left Russia without seeing the revolution. In that respect, he did not have the opportunity to learn from the mistakes that everyone else was beginning to make as Tsarism dissolved. On a posting to Italy later that year, however, he continued to play the spying game. The strain of war was testing all of Britain's continental allies, including Italy, and morale was further dented by the activities of left-wing pacifists who drew their inspiration from the Petrograd Soviet. In an attempt to neutralise these local peace protesters, Hoare authorised the covert payment of £100 a month to a promising Italian journalist. At 34, Benito Mussolini was already starting to emerge as a persuasive and red-blooded type. He and Hoare would meet again some years later. As Britain's foreign secretary, Hoare was the architect of the Hall of Al Pact in 1935, a scandalous deal, never implemented, intended to give Mussolini a free hand with his tanks and poison gas in parts of Abyssinia. The reckoning for the defeated German Empire came in 1919. As they filed into the mirrored hall of the Palace of Versailles, its diplomats could count on few old friends. The leader of the German delegation was Pavu Sponser from wartime Copenhagen, Ulrich von Brockdorff-Rantzau. Like Pavu's, he had seen his happiest and most creative days. Lenin did not honour any debt incurred to patrons from his past, and most would understand what was about to happen only when it was too late. Now a German national at last, Pavus was horrified by the news from Versailles. "If you destroy Germany," he warned the victors from his new base near Berlin, "you will make the German nation the organizer of the next world war." The big man had come to believe that the only future for himself, for Europe and for mankind, lay in a strong Germany and a united Western Europe. He harboured no illusions about Lenin's Russia. He considered the place to have assumed the grisly proportions of a reincarnated Tsarism. It did not help that Lenin had not ventured to reward him, nor that the Soviet state had branded him a traitor, shutting him out of a drama that he once dreamed of orchestrating. Closer to home, the Swiss police had orders to arrest him for his wartime economic crimes. Thwarted, but still in fighting mood, he used a portion of his wealth to build himself a mansion at Schwanenwerder, just outside Berlin. The Wannsee had its own romantic shore, but it was a far cry from the Bauer Lack. "This is terrible," he wrote to a young friend. "I need change and life, and all I see is decay, slime, dislocation. I want intellectual creativeness, the joy of hope, the triumph of spiritual achievements, the joy of new discoveries. I would like to feel again the heartbeat of civilization." That joy eluded him forever. Pavus died in 1924, age 55. The younger generation knows his name as the name of a betrayer of the working class, a social patriot, wrote Karl Radek. He combined in one person the spirit of a German social democrat and of a speculator. Coming from his erstwhile friend, the words were cruel enough, but worse was to come. Stalin quickly added Pavu's name to the list of enemies and former men. The millionaire socialist was never mentioned in Moscow again. There were no plaques or statues, and no footnotes in Soviet books. As if anticipating that darkness, Pavus had destroyed most of his papers in the last months of his life. His fortune also disappeared, burned, buried, squandered, and with it vanished the last trace of his remarkable career. Pavus had underestimated Lenin's ruthlessness, and the Germans had failed to realise in time that they were sponsoring a man whose personal sense of mission appeared, to him, to warrant any violence. The greatest suffering of all, however, was Lenin's own society. The hatreds from the old days had not had the chance to heal, while new ones, stoked by the language of class, swept through the masses like a blaze. A leader who is not in some degree a tyrant is impossible, wrote Maxim Gorky, in the sycophantic mood of his old age. More people probably were killed under Lenin than under Thomas Munzer. But without this, resistance to the revolution of which Lenin was the leader would have been more widely and powerfully organized. Though he had witnessed not a single battle at first hand, Lenin came to power in a world distorted by the shock of mechanized slaughter. On the pretext of ending that, he used the new technologies of war himself, while in the course of 3 years of internal conflict, his people also tore at human flesh with pitchforks, mattocks, knives, and teeth. There was no refuge for compassion or remorse. A struggle for survival, the bloodbath was justified, on all sides, with slogans, lies, and ideology. Explode, chop apart, the old world. A poem of the time enjoined. Be merciless, strangle. The bony body of destiny. As trusted and experienced comrades, Lenin's companions of the sealed train were bound to be swept up in revolutionary storms. Grigory Yuzevich was the first to die, killed in an early battle of the Civil War. As a new banking commissar, however, an economist called Grigory Sokolnikov had other ways of repaying the cost of his cheap seat to Petrograd. In 1918, when Lenin's government was desperate for usable hard cash, he presided over the long-promised expropriation of Russia's robber capitalists, which meant opening tens of thousands of private safe deposit boxes and stealing, revising, the contents. By the end of its first year, this wholesale raid had yielded 500 million Tsarist rubles, or roughly $250 million. At the same time, the loyal Fürstenberg was also put to work in his specialized area of trading and supply. He spent months buying boots in bulk before he was promoted to the directorship of the Soviet National Bank, a role in which he could exploit financial contacts in Stockholm. It was not as easy for everyone. After years of tireless underground work, Shlapnikov made the mistake, in political terms, of retaining a direct association with the factory workers of Petrograd. He felt he could do nothing else, for they were his comrades in arms, and as a skilled lathe operator, he identified with their concerns. Like them, therefore, he could only watch in horror as Lenin's government became as dictatorial and as merciless as any industrial baron of the past. Shlapnikov's group began to clash with Lenin on questions of workers' control and the rights of trade unions from 1920. But it was the introduction of a mixed economy, the so-called new economic policy, with its concessions to capitalist practices, that drove his workers' opposition to full-scale revolt. In 1921, Lenin described a new faction as the greatest danger to our continued existence. None of poor Shlapnikov's pre-revolutionary loyalty counted for anything, as loaded guns dispersed his following and its ideas. Thereafter, factional activity of any kind was banned forever. In the space of only 4 years, the Bolshevik Party had turned its back on the very source of dynamism that had propelled Lenin to power. The Soviet dictatorship, a government that promised freedom for all working people, had created a tyranny. But the dream remained powerful, and when Lenin died in 1924, the country genuinely mourned. Stalin was another matter. "Your socialism," Raskolnikov, the former Petrograd activist, informed the people's leader in an open letter of 1939, "can find room for those who built it only behind prison bars. Your personal dictatorship is without anything in common with the dictatorship of the proletariat." Soon after he had written that, and though he'd escaped to France, Raskolnikov was dead, quite possibly from poisoning. No one ever found a culprit, however, and very few would ever look. The problem was that communists in general were wary of assigning blame. No individual, their ideology had taught, could ever question the collective cause. Stalin's future victims clung hard to Lenin's Marxist rhetoric in an attempt to justify themselves, eschewing the notion of individual wickedness by reference to social force and class struggle. None ever challenged the desirability of revolution as a goal. Instead, they thought of all the reasons why, on this or that occasion, Russia might have failed to measure up. When they had finished blaming the peasants, this remained Russia's national sport, they reverted to a damaging self-scrutiny. History, after all, could not be wrong. So the people whom it had called to serve must somehow have failed it. For decades, communists of every kind picked at the fraying edges of their ideology, defining and denouncing each other's mistakes. The debates echoed something of the Soviet of 1917, for they were abstract, well-intentioned, literate, and doomed. Having grown up under the conditions of revolutionary struggle against the old regime, wrote one contemporary, we'd all been trained in the psychology of oppositionists, of irreconcilable nonconformists. In short, we were all critics, destructionists, not builders. By the end of 1927, just 10 years after Lenin's own triumphant coup, Stalin was more or less omnipotent in the Kremlin. When the French communist Victor Serge visited Radek in his Kremlin suite in December that year, he found the disgraced politician packing up to leave. Instead of riches, all he had to show for his career was a vast pile of books. We've been absolute idiots, Radek fumed. We haven't a halfpenny. When we could have kept back some petty spoils of war for ourselves, today we're being killed off through lack of money. We, with our celebrated revolutionary honesty, we've just been over-scrupulous sods of intellectuals. The over-scrupulous sods had lost. Trotsky was exiled to Central Asia. Zinoviev and Kamenev were expelled from the party and hounded by Stalin's policemen. Radek was packed off to the Siberian town of Tobolsk. Even Krupskaya, who had shared their opposition to the Stalin line, was targeted in an obscene whispering campaign. Within the ranks of the apparatus, wrote Trotsky, they systematically compromised her, blackened her, degraded her. The rumour spread that it was Inessa Armand who had been the leader's real love, that Krupskaya had been a deadweight, dowdy and absurd. At one point, Stalin even muttered that he could make someone else Lenin's widow. Blackmail and bullying behind the scenes guaranteed the ailing woman's silence after 1926. In years to come, she died in 1939, this tireless underground conspirator and lifelong socialist was gagged. Her rich experience of Lenin, now too dangerous to share. She could not even get her memoirs into print until they had been purged of Trotsky's name. Zinoviev was shot with Kamenev in 1936. His son Stefan, who, as a little boy in Switzerland, had enchanted Lenin so much that the leader once attempted to adopt him, was shot in 1937. Zinoviev's second wife and travelling companion of 1917, who is exiled to one of the most northern labour colonies, was shot in 1938. His first wife, Olga Ravitch, the woman who had irritated Lenin with her piercing laugh, was arrested for her part in the alleged opposition and spent 2 decades in the Arctic camps. Neither age nor gender was a defence, and nor was infirmity. Shlapnikov's torment was particularly cruel. In 1933, he wrote to Stalin personally, pleading that he had gone almost completely deaf and that he wanted to retire into his silent world. The following year, by way of answer, Stalin had him tried and exiled to the Kola Peninsula, one of the coldest places on the planet. He was recalled several months later, humiliated and frightened, before being freed, arrested, and then tried again. Nothing that he'd witnessed at the hands of the Tsarist police had been remotely as sadistic or gratuitous. In September 1937, and still protesting his innocence, he was shot for his supposed involvement in Zinoviev's so-called conspiracy. If the deaf and enfeebled Shlapnikov was marked for death, then Sukhanov, a Menshevik, and author of the best eyewitness chronicle of Petrograd's brief revolutionary spring, was bound to end up in the Kremlin's sights. A Serbic, though he always was, he had remained in Russia to take part in the future he had glimpsed with so much rapture from the steps of the Taurid. Ambition proved to be a trap. How can one describe the condition of people who sensed with all their being the approach of a terrible disaster? Asked the Soviet writer, Boris Yefimov, and did not know how to escape it, how to save themselves, and remained bound and helpless in a nightmare. Sukarnoff was arrested in an early cull of 1931. Arriving in the labour camp at Verkhne-Uralsk, he attempted to evade his fate by reminding his captors that he had cooperated willingly in the weeks before his trial. He had betrayed a lot of friends. He had a right to his reward. The secret police spirited him from the convict's crowded dormitory, and no one in the outside world would ever hear from him again. Karl Radek's tactics were broadly the same. His exile in Tobolsk was unbearable. So he wrote to Stalin in the spring of 1929, accepting the new party line, denouncing Trotsky as a terrorist, and pleaded to come back and serve in Moscow. The tyrant was amused enough to grant his wish. And for a few years, Radek acted as Stalin's fawning spokesman. But he'd already been warned about his promiscuous wit. Muscovites quipped that Radek was the origin of every anti-Stalin joke in Russia. "Most men's heads control their tongues," Stalin remarked. "Radek's tongue controls his head." Radek was arrested in October 1936 on treason charges and stood trial the following January. Among his fellow defendants was Grigory Sokolnikov, the banker and economist, another veteran of Lenin's train. Unusually, neither man received a death sentence. Radek had bought his paltry reprieve by implicating former comrades in a new and imaginary terrorist network. The betrayal spared him a bullet, but it did not save his life for long. Though their murders were made to look like the result of accidental brawls, Radek and Sokolnikov were beaten to death in their respective labour camps within a few days of each other. As a Pole and a businessman, efficient and still sporting a crisp suit, Fürstenberg had no idea that his cards had also been marked. It was true that he had not kept his original job in the financial world. With the absurdity that was characteristic of the times, he had been moved to the State Administration of Music and Entertainment. And then, in yet another reshuffle, he had taken over the management of Moscow's circuses and public concerts. His Danse Macabre would end in July 1937. As the police went through his flat, he tried to scribble a note to Stalin, clutching his pencil so tightly that it kept breaking. "A nightmarish tragic accident has occurred," he scrawled. "They have arrested me tonight. They are already calling me an enemy. What's going on? How could such a ghastly mistake be made?" There never were mistakes, of course. The police confiscated a pile of compromising books from the Fürstenberg's flat, including works by many of the comrades that the businessman had helped: Radek and Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, and Shlapnikov. The arresting officers may well have pocketed a souvenir or two before they wrote it, but their report insisted that Russia's former banker possessed no other valuables worth mentioning beyond $2 and a collection of antique revolvers. The next steps were the usual ones: a short but polite questioning, a beating, tearful pleading, and humiliation in a blood-stained room. His torturers were more fastidious than usual. The party did not want to draw attention to those past transfers of German cash. But Fürstenberg was shot, as were his wife and son, after a 15-minute trial. His daughter spent years in the camps, still believing her mother and brother to be alive. As for Fritz Platten, the Swiss socialist and on-train go-between, he had crossed the border into Russia many times after his failed attempt in 1917. Having spent nearly two decades in the service of the Soviet state, he was arrested in 1939 and sentenced to exile in the Archangel region, where he died in 1942. Lenin's real opponents often had a better time. In the brief interval when flight was possible, that route through Finland was busy again. A number of former members of the provisional government and Soviet executive escaped to France. Germany, after all, was not an option. By the 1920s, there was a lively, disputatious Russian colony in Paris. Chiedza and Tseretelli both lived there, and they shared their exile with an array of their former adversaries, including Prince Georgi Levov, Mikhail Tereshchenko, and Paul Milyukov. While never loath to argue as they smoked their long, fragrant cigars, these gentlemen tended to use the leisure that they now enjoyed to justify themselves in print. Many would contribute to Russian-language newspapers, new titles in the émigré tradition of the ones that had flourished in France before the war. The most determined, however, wrote memoirs. Milyukov remained obsessed with the issues of foreign policy and liberal reform that had inspired his brief political career, while Tseretelli, who wrote his memoirs later in New York, laboured to reconstruct the agonising compromises of that fatal spring. Neither enjoyed the same celebrity as Kerensky. Drama had followed him until the last. Most members of his final cabinet were arrested in October 1917. They had repaired to the white dining room inside the Winter Palace, but he made his escape in an American embassy car. He had a plan to organise an uprising against the Leninists, but it did not come off. Months later, Robert Bruce Lockhart, by now the head of the British mission, helped him to emigrate on a false visa. Kerensky, once adored and fêted, often showered with bouquets, was to live modestly at first, joining the Russian community in France, and continuing to rail against the Bolsheviks. He escaped for a second time, as Hitler's troops approached in 1940. His future lay in the United States. Lenin remained his nemesis. Where others skimmed over the drama of the sealed train, Kerensky wallowed in it, always regretting the fact that he had not, as he put it, had time enough to prove the case about Lenin's connection with the German government. Blaming Lenin, then, became a way of letting himself off the hook. It also allowed him to claim that Russia might not have been doomed in battle and on the home front, despite the mounting pile of evidence suggesting otherwise. While he deplored those tragedies, however, Kerensky quickly reconciled himself to the new world, and his old age was an agreeable companion of scholarship and minor celebrity. He published several versions of his own memoirs and helped to edit a classic multi-volume selection of primary documents from 1917. Although Kerensky could be standoffish at times, a fellow professor of Stanford remembered, he developed a great circle of academic friends, loved a good party, and mixed well, especially with the ladies. By 1937, according to a Russian observer, the Soviet public was utterly sick of politics and wanted nothing but to be left in peace and to be able to live in peace. It was a cry that everyone had heard before, and the mature Soviet regime certainly needed something more than violence to get people to slave for it. As Trotsky had said, in a different context, masses of men cannot be led to death unless the army command has the death penalty in its arsenal. Yet armies are not built on fear. The propaganda of the 1930s set the standard for its genre. Combining all the fun of mass events with stirring messages of hope, it offered citizens a shining dream in a place of private comfort and traditional community. The dream was false. The party's leaders were a charmless and malicious clique, but Lenin was always with them. That was the slogan anyway, and he was not the type to let them down. The cult of Lenin was a flagrant lie. Simplifying anything that it did not fake, it reduced its hero to an unconvincing plaster saint, a sort of cartoon Uncle Vlad. Lenin was both more and less than this. No statue, song, or festival could capture the ambition of his dream, and none could blot the bloodstains from its execution. This uncle had sent tens of thousands to their deaths. The system he created was a stifling, cruel, sterile one, a workshop for decades of tyranny, and yet his cult was all that stood between the people and their fear of chaos and another civil war. The idea of turning his body into a permanent exhibit developed slowly over several years, but by the 1930s, his mausoleum and the corpse within it were on Red Square to stay. That mausoleum was an insult to the countless bodies Lenin had destroyed, and there was no excuse for keeping the remains inside, except to demonstrate beyond all doubt that one monster really was dead. Though Stalin was more than capable of formulating those ideas in private, however, outwardly he exploited the body like a holy relic. The high hopes of 1917 were fading by the time he came to power. Lenin's death cult boosted them again by invoking the ghost of ideas that had set the wartime world alight. Immortal Lenin put all doubt to shame. His shrine reminded everyone that Russians were the pioneers of mankind's progress toward socialism. In life, the greatest Bolshevik on earth had led his people in their sacred world historic struggle. In faith, and with his help, announced the propaganda in its boldest print, they would fight on, and die, if need be, for the sake of a collective human destiny. To avoid distraction and weakness, meanwhile, even Soviet people needed leadership, and that happened to be Stalin's forte. The cult survived for 60 years, because it kept a bankrupt polity intact. Lenin stayed dead. Yet he was always near at hand, convenient, and dependable. For as long as the Soviet Empire lasted, the Lenin statues could be mocked, but they were not torn down. The anti-Lenin jokes were funny, precisely because Lenin was there, as dowdy, reassuring, and immovable as a blacklead kitchen range. "The Jubilee Year," read Pravda, on the 16th of April, 1967, "the 50th anniversary of Lenin's return to the Finland station. Let's start it well." The words were meaningless, and the newspaper would end up in pieces on the paper nail in some earth privy within hours. But Lenin held the universe aloft, and the alternative, as the leaders occasionally ventured to hint, was almost guaranteed catastrophe. By sleight of hand, one of the most epic revolutions in history was made to double as a sermon on the value of a strong, vigilant state. The most dangerous time was the late 1980s, when Mikhail Gorbachev announced his policy of glasnost. Over the next few years, historians stripped Soviet mythology of each lie in succession, beginning with the Gulag, and soon turning to October 1917. In the process, almost every Soviet hero was exposed as a blackguard or a thief. But though he took a few half-hearted blows, Lenin came off better than the rest. His relationship with Inessa distracted many readers from genuine stories of his cruelty. For a few years in the early 1990s, the government withdrew its funding from the team that maintained the dead leader's corpse. But the approach of the millennium brought better times and ever fatter envelopes of cash. Even the hiring scribblers did not manage to blacken his name, a latter-day communist wrote in Pravda in April 1997. This was another false statement, for researchers had found abundant evidence of Lenin as mass murderer. But it was true that his cult, like his mummified remains, had made it safely into the post-Soviet age. Vladimir Putin became president in 2000, and for a while after that, Russia's leaders chose to focus on an undisputed victory, the triumph that they called the Great Patriotic War, rather than reflecting too much on the controversial revolutionary stuff. The public celebration of Lenin's coup, marked annually on the 7th of November, was replaced in 2005 by something called National Unity Day, celebrated on the 4th of November, an allusion to events that took place in a long-forgotten century, the 17th, and whose heroes did not look at all like anyone around today. But as the centenary of Russia's Year of Revolutions approached, it was clear that Lenin's role would have to be commemorated. The state needed to take the lead, to seize control lest others might. Bishops were called to the Kremlin. Historians, slack-jowled from years of euphemism, assembled at their reserved seats. Microphones were positioned. And warm, sparkling wine awaited as the speeches, as they always do, ran well past their allotted time. The budget for Russia's centenary events in 2017 was sumptuous, In general, the message, though the transcripts use more words than this, was that a lot of people suffered, and the Russians of the present day will not forget. The technique was to keep things bland. Long speeches in assorted, overheated rooms were excellent for this, while cartoon strips could tell the public stories that already bored them in a pleasantly nostalgic way. At all costs, the image of Petrograd, as it had been in a far-off spring, with angry crowds and troops abandoning their posts, had to stay firmly in the past, for recent reruns, springs for people close to home, had been disastrous to Russia's interests in the Baltic, Georgia, and Ukraine. We will commemorate the 400th anniversary of the Romanovs, observed Novaya Gazeta's Kirill Martinov in 2015, and immediately after it, the centenary of the October Revolution. We will mark the day of the Chekist, Lenin's secret police, and then, without delay, the day of remembrance for the victims of political repression. Putin, Stalin, Lenin, and Nicholas II, holding each other by the hand, are leading Russia from victory to victory. Like concrete, smothering, precocious shoots, the festival would flatten any awkward curiosity before it could be vocalized. As Culture Minister Vladimir Medinsky put it, a series of centenary commemorations in 2017 would encourage people to understand the importance for Russia of strong state power, supported by all layers of the population. If Lenin's corpse survives all this, it will not be by accident. It takes a lot of skill to keep him fresh. Each year, not long after the Christmas break, vigilant Muscovites watch for an ambulance bumping across Red Square. Inside it, Lenin is being taken for maintenance. In 2015, as the leader's 145th birthday loomed, someone with influence decided that he also deserved a new suit. Experts in a special lab removed the existing trousers and jacket, the old shirt, tie and woolen socks. Beneath them, the corpse was clothed, as always, in a double-layered bodysuit of clear rubber, whose purpose is to trap a film of embalming fluid over what is left of the skin. The removal of this demands a delicate touch, but there are practiced fingers to command, for the embalming coat, a gruesome sort of body stocking, has needed changing regularly for more than 90 years. While it is off, the naked corpse, with waxy patches here and there, must be revived in a series of chemical baths, each one infused with a more sinister preservative cocktail. A brand new rubber film is then eased on, sealing the fluid underneath. That done, the tailors may come in to measure up. Dead though he is, this Lenin is an awkward presence in the Russia of Vladimir Putin, which is itself an artifact whose oily coat conceals unfathomable depths of rot. The current regime takes its cue from Russia's old-time czars. The president has borrowed a good deal from the Romanovs' faux Byzantine style. That gold, those uniforms, the whole imperial parade, and like them, he makes ample use of Russia's ultra-nationalist church. In January 2016, perhaps to test the public appetite for getting rid of the expensive body in Red Square, Putin ventured to accuse Lenin of undermining Russia's unity and, more importantly, its tight hold on Ukraine by encouraging movements for national autonomy in the old Tsarist Empire. Ideas like that, Putin informed a scientific conference, planted an atomic bomb under the house that we called Russia, and it eventually collapsed. An outcry led to recantation, with Putin's press secretary hastily claiming that the president's words were just a personal view. He may be noxious, and he may cost millions to keep in shape, but Lenin has a charisma that still holds many Russians in its grip. We are grateful to Lenin, the curator of the Pravda Museum explained. It is because of Lenin that we still have all this. that we survived. We are in a fine building on the Moika, and she'd been showing me the floor where Pravda had been written and produced from February to July 1917. Thanks to state money over many years, a good deal of the old clutter has been preserved, including Lenin's small office, large leather-topped desk with green-shaded lamps, papers, Bakelite telephone, and the staff room next door, bentwood chairs, round table, scattering of antique newspapers, more books. Next comes the print room, airy and flooded with light. Few of the presses are original. The ones that produced Pravda have been lost. And the room, whose tiled floors keeps it always cool, was used to store meat carcasses for many years. But the curators have restored it as an exhibition of printing history, and it is beautiful. The problem, and it afflicts every Lenin site, is that visitor numbers have declined since 1991. The collapse of the Soviet state was bad news for the revolution industry in general, and latterly, few Russians have much time to spare from shopping and computer screens. The Pravda Museum no longer features on prescribed school tours in Russia, and negative political publicity in the foreign press has caused a drop in tourist visits by outsiders in the past few years. To save their jobs, to say nothing of their heritage, museum staff have been forced to adapt. My guide took up the story as we walked. "These rooms," she said, "are now called the Museum of Tolerance." Since I was visiting during a sanctions war, I found the idea startling, and Lenin might have bridled too, for tolerance was never a strong point. On Russia's new curriculum for schools, however, the relevant module is compulsory. "The exhibit shows us what Russia owes to Europe," the guide explained. As we spoke, European cheese was being bulldozed into landfill somewhere near the Russo-Belarusian border. "The piano is English, for instance, and the typewriter was made in Germany before 1914. Museum staff are not to blame. Inventive, energetic, committed. They do their best to keep the interest alive. But as long as Russia's electorate continues to evade responsibility for what its government chooses to do, investing in a set of fantasies as wild as many of the Lenin years, no light can be allowed to shine on the hard questions of the past. Too much reality is disturbing, especially when Putin's media strategy is based so heavily on his ability to soothe. Keep Lenin dead. That's the idea. If people cannot live without his relics, then store the lot like nuclear waste. Contain the fallout. Make sure everyone stays calm. A rubber skin across the top will trap both lifeblood and corruption out of sight. The history of Lenin's train must be preserved, and yet it must not be allowed to move. Everything is sacred, but nothing must ever signify. I remember my first apartment museum, the one where Lenin lived with his sisters. The prize exhibit there was one of Lenin's wheelchairs, ironically English-made, that someone had rescued when a museum near Moscow closed in the difficult 1990s. It was incongruous in St. Petersburg, especially in an apartment that the leader himself did not revisit in the years of his infirmity. The curator was glad to have the object, however, and prouder still to wheel it out and let me touch. But then she talked about the clock. "We cannot have it repaired," she told me, as I raised an eyebrow at the lifeless pendulum. "It was here when Lenin was, so it is too precious to send out to a repair shop. But we cannot afford to have an expert come to us. All we can do is to keep it here. We must look after it." The clock had stopped in every sense, and the effect is suffocating. There was another Lenin once, and he was neither bland nor dead. This man belongs to the springtime of hope, and it was revolution that defined his life. The only lively Lenin monument is also one of the very first, the work of someone who had known the man for real. The statue stands outside the Finland station in St. Petersburg, and it was erected in 1926, 2 years after the leader's death. Despite its monstrous size and weight, this Lenin has all the energy of the original. He stands high on an armoured car, his feet in shop-bought Swedish shoes, and while his left hand has been tucked into the armpit of his bronze waistcoat, the right is thrusting forwards, emphatic, strong, forever in command. This recording of Lenin on the Train was presented by Dreamscape Media LLC. Text copyright 2016 by Catherine Merridale. Sound recording copyright 2017, Dreamscape Media LLC. Thank you for listening. Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.